Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Fidelia. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. Thank you very much. You've got us connected one more time. And ladies and gentlemen, I must mention that I never showed up last week for the show, and that was not Audrey's fault. And I did the show the week before, and the week before that, we didn't do a show. It was not Audrey's fault. It was other commitments. But anyway, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Show. It's not called the Blog Talk Radio Show, although it is the Blog Talk Radio Show. And it's the Jumble Justice Radio Show. And tonight we got a really crazy bunch of news. I mean, some really silly things. But the feature topic tonight in our speaker is Brad Ricca. He's going to be talking about his book, Mrs. Sherlock Holmes, the story of New York City's greatest female detective in the 1917 missing girl case that captivated a nation. I think you'll find this very interesting. I'm a big fan of history in general, but criminal justice history, and written a few things about it, but never a whole book, or even a book chapter, but some articles on criminal justice historical things. But just remember, you can go to Google News and go to the history section of the news and type, you can read newspapers from, how does Google do it? You can read newspapers that are 300 and 400 years old. Can you believe that? I mean, how in the world? Mr. Google is just absolutely something. But anyway, I think you'll find this interesting to hear Mr. Ricca talk about this famous female detective who was a consulting detective with the New York City Police Department. And when somebody's good like that, they can consult around the whole country, and you know, the world's full of specialists in criminal justice who in fact make a living doing that. But anyway, that's what we're going to do for tonight for our speaking engagement. But we'll start off tonight with a little bit of this criminal justice news, and some of this stuff is really crazy. Let's look at this one about Cleveland, Ohio. The Cleveland police and they're a persistent panhandler have been engaged in a war of wills for years at a homely West Side intersection, a conflict that appears to subside. Only one man is in jail. Only one person they've locked up. And it's a guy, he's a 60-year-old David Spaulding, has been cited more than 250 times for panhandling since 2013. 250 since 2015, and all the citations written by the police at the intersection in the neighborhood, best known for what Ariel Castro once held three young women captive for years. Remember that story? I won't elaborate. But the ACLU is suing the city in federal court this week on behalf of a homeless man, John Mancini, and an advocacy group that claims the city's panhandling laws are unconstitutional because they make pleas of poverty a crime. Cleveland police issued more than 5,800 panhandling citations between 2007 and the August of 2015. I can remember back in the Ice Age working the streets and worked downtown beat for some time, and a lot of the panhandlers were down there. And the homeless, I mean, some of them were incredible people. I mean, I've talked to you more about that, or about that in the past, but the one guy that had the drunk arrest record, he'd been arrested over 300 times for drunk, and he was a master plumber, and they loved to get him on an extended stay from like November through April or May, 6 months, so that he could get fix all their plumbing at the workhouse in Dayton, Ohio. But isn't that something, that's all these panhandlers living on the street, and who knows? Here's something people aren't fond of. Police departments around the country are amassing their own DNA databases to track criminals. This is a move, they say, it's a way of around regulations governing state and national databases that restrict who can provide genetic samples and how long that information can be held. So these agencies create the rules for their own databases, in some cases allowing samples to be taken from children or from people never arrested for a crime. Police chiefs say they have their own collections and they help them solve cases faster than they can avoid the backups that plague state and federal repositories. Should the police be collecting DNA like that, and they're getting it from saliva and blood and fingerprints and all kinds of stuff? I don't know much about DNA. Saliva, semen, hair, and skin are among the biological clues that the criminal might leave at a crime scene. And they say it's working for them. You know, they're making more arrests based on that, but do you want your DNA collected everywhere you go? Who knows? Maybe they'll just systematically start collecting your DNA at the grocery store or whatever and match it with your name. I don't know. Anyway, here's what I'm not going to talk about, this wiretapping stuff. I was before. Are you tired of hearing about, it's important, I know, but about the CIA and wiretapping, President candidate Trump and all this? I mean, it goes on and on and on. And I'm just surprised places like Fox News, they start at 6 in the morning and never stop. If you want to see some real world news, go to the BBC. They're actually off their couch and out in the field somewhere around the world covering stories. I like Fox News and I'm a big fan of them, but sometimes they just go on and on to the extent that it's almost nauseating. All right, do you hear about this? When a street gang slipped with ease in a Norfolk Southern Railroad car yard in Chicago South this past week, and they ripped the locks off one train, they likely expected to see merchandise like toys or tennis shoes. What they held instead and saw was a gangster's jackpot, box after box of brand new firearms. So they were able to get these guns out of their 45 caliber Ruger revolvers and on and on and on, and along with two other major gun thefts within 3 years, the robbery helped fuel a wave of violence on Chicago streets. So, you know, this is really something. It'd be this was luck, I guess, for these characters, these criminals, but it happens. Did you know? I know this is news breaking, but did you know that Mexican drug cartels are fueling the U.S. heroin epidemic? FBI Director James Comey finally figured that out. I'll bet the LA police in Houston and Toledo and Detroit, I bet they could probably given him a little hint on that ahead of time. But he was joined by the Chuck Rosenberg, the acting administrator of the DEA. He said Mexican cartels have cornered the heroin market in the United States with increasingly low cost and potent products. But, oh my gosh, can we ever stop this? And the poppy population and cultivation in Mexico is just going on and on and on and on. Oh, here's one that's close to my heart. I used to hate to see this. A man was attacked by two dogs last month in Los Angeles. He's finally died. But two pit bull type dogs mauled Valentin Herrera, 76 years old, and his little dog, Dodger, just a block from his house. Dodger was killed instantly. Herrera, the dog, Herrera had brain and arm surgeries, but they could not save him. Can you believe that? These people, I see these pit bulls out on the street and they're walking with people and they take the leash off of them on these dog paths and all this stuff. And when I bike and I run, I take protection because I remember as a cop, you know what these people would say? You heard me say it on this radio show. When you go do a dog bite complaint and you're a cop, they'll say, well, he doesn't bite. He doesn't bite. I didn't know he bites people. He doesn't bite the owner. He bites everybody else on the street, or she. I don't know who's the worst dog. Do you know, Audrey? Female dogs, do they bite more than male dogs? Be an interesting research project. But anyway, that's just incredible, isn't it? That this guy dies at the hands of two pit bulls, or the paws of two pit bulls. Here's another one I thought was funny. Hey, you don't have to be real smart to be a criminal, but sometimes it helps. An 18-year-old man accused of committing three armed carjackings in a 10-day span was arrested because he didn't know how to drive a stick shift, according to court records. Damari Wayne, age 18, he's charged with three counts of aggravated robbery. He's being held in a city jail on a $100,000 bond in Cleveland. Wayne stole three cars at gunpoint, February 11 through February 21. He committed two armed carjackings in 1 hour. What is wrong with that character? Is he trying to break a record so he can go viral with a video or something? But he stole the first car in the evening of February 11 from a 35-year-old man. Four people surrounded the man. One took the man's keys, and two hopped in the Nissan Acura. But the teen jumped into this passenger car, and wait a minute, what's the story here? Yeah. The 17-year-old guy, he got in the driver's seat, but he couldn't drive a stick shift. The teen pointed the gun at the 23-year-old man while the man tried to explain how to use the gears, according to the court records. That's something that's very kind when you explain to your carjacker how to use the gears. But can you believe that dope couldn't use his gears? Oh, my gosh. Oh, police in Ohio's capital say more cops will carry a drug overdose antidote after dozens of heroin users were revived with it during a pilot program. The Columbus Dispatch said a police department commander's report on the program indicated officers administered naloxone, is that how you pronounce it? I know nothing about drugs. 58 times during the 6-month program, sometimes giving multiple doses to one person. All but one of the recipients survived. That's great. Of course, there's another way to survive is don't take that stuff. I don't know why they keep doing it. The pilot program had about 125 officers carrying the reversal drug, also known by the brand name Narcan. The commander said the department intends to widen its use of this program. Some officers don't want to do it. Some officers say they do not want to carry naloxone. The president of the local police union said officers want to save lives but are wary of becoming medical care providers, you know? I think the guy is making a point there. He could make a point. hey, I'm going to skip this one about Philadelphia. Well, it says that the people in Philadelphia are being trained because of all the shootings. They're being trained to save lives. Philadelphia's already seen nearly four dozen murders this year, and it's a 38% increase from this time last year. So they're trying to train people in the neighborhoods to provide survival techniques to the people who are shot and left on the street or left on somebody's porch or something like that. But isn't that terrible that we're actually living in a time like that? I mean, the deaths are just absolutely incredible. Okay, that's enough That's enough for the news. Let's have a green tip for tonight. How about this? Do you know if you avoid drive-through restaurants, McDonald's, Hardee's, on and on and on, Taco Bell, the basic rule of thumb is that idling a car for more than 10 seconds is a waste of fuel, and the engine should be turned off. In light of that, using a drive-through is a big waste of energy and a source of pollution. So you should challenge yourself, will you do that, not to use drive-through restaurants anymore, walk in and get your meal, and you'll get a little exercise from that also. Now, that's a great idea. I think I'll try that tomorrow. Let me see what else we got here. We have a... Wait. Told you about handwriting is back. It's the blonde joke. We do blonde jokes on this show, don't we? So where did it go? Oh, there it is. Oh, Audrey likes this one. A British Airway employee took a call from a blonde asking this question. How long is the flight from London to New York? Just a minute, he said. Then as he turned to check the exact flight time, he heard the blonde say, thank you, as the phone went dead. Keep in mind that's a male blonde, so don't get excited about it, all right? Okay, I think what we're going to do now is switch pretty quickly here to the discussion of Rick's book about the famous New York City police detective, female, in 1917, she worked on a very famous case in that time, and these were very interesting times in policing. Do people know at one time in New York City the police did not carry firearms? A long time ago, that was based on London. I don't even know now, but 15, 20 years ago, most London police still didn't carry guns. I don't know if they do now. I'm ashamed to say that. But anyway, give me time to get this set up, and I think you'll enjoy listening to Brad Ricca, and he's the author of the book, Mrs. Sherlock Holmes. I'm going to move this up a little bit so we can get out of a lot of the introduction stuff.
We're going to talk true crime today, and I have a confession to make. This is a detective book in so many ways, a mystery book, is that I really hate true crime. And I know hate is one of those, but again, I said once. So that's my introduction. I'm going to read you part of the mystery that is Mrs. Sherlock Holmes. There was important news on the front page that day, but it was the photograph of a girl in a white dress that made people stop and stare. Appearing just below the headline, the young woman was not famous, but she certainly looked familiar. She was seated with her hands at her side, her dark hair pulled up and back, topped off by a great white bow. She was seated with her hands at her side. She smiled out past the stories of U-boat attacks and President Woodrow Wilson, her face blurred by gray halftone dots. Ruth Kruger was 18 years old when she appeared on the front page of the New York Evening World on the day after Valentine's Day, 1917. She had been missing for 2 days. Ruth had left her family's apartment on the previous Tuesday to have her ice skates sharpened. When she didn't come home, her family called the police. Detectives tramped through the snow and rapped on doors. They tracked down rumors of a secret boyfriend and talked to witnesses who said they saw her stagger into a mysterious taxi cab. But these clues led nowhere. The owner of the motorcycle shop where Ruth had picked up her skates, an Italian named Alfredo Cocchi, led detectives let detectives search his store until they were satisfied. As the snow melted and weeks turned into months, the police concluded that Ruth had probably just eloped with an unknown suitor. Ruth's father, Henry, didn't like that. He wrote a pointed letter to the mayor. Then he held a press conference. In front of reporters representing many of Gotham's nearly 20 daily newspapers, Henry Krueger, a short, bald accountant, told all of New York City that his daughter was a good girl and had unquestionably been kidnapped. Henry's wife and two other daughters stood beside him, their eyes red and wet. Perched behind them all was an older woman wearing a black dress with a matching hat that swept down her neck like a sick old bird. She looked to be in her 50s and was presumed to be the missing girl's grandmother, apparently already grieving. So when Henry Krueger introduced this woman in black, as the family's new lawyer and primary investigator, the reporters were surprised when she snapped forward and demanded that from now on all clues be given directly to her. Her name was Mrs. Grace Humiston, and for the work she was about to do on the sensational Krueger case, facing off against corrupt police, an unseen criminal society, the insatiable New York media, and a mysterious pale man, reporters would give her the singular moniker of Mrs. Sherlock Holmes. In two short months, Grace Humiston would become the most famous female detective in America. In less than a year, she would disappear. Born in 1869 with a claim to old New York money, Grace, her name then Winterton, went to Hunter College before embarking on what she thought would be a long teaching career at the all-boys collegiate school on the Upper West Side. After she was married, her husband, Dr. Henry Quackenbush, was accused of peephole practices at his office, divorced him, quit her job, and enrolled in an evening class at the NYU School of Law, the only school in the city that admitted women. Seated in the front row, she graduated in two short years, ranked seventh in her class. Around this time, she also began to wear black. After a short stint at the Legal Aid Society, she passed the bar and opened the People's Law Firm. The woman in black began to get an almost legendary reputation among the New York immigrant poor. She challenged government deportations, helped underage child workers who weren't being paid at their jobs, and even recovered lost jewels for a grateful foreign ambassador. After winning a highly publicized appeal that saved the life of a young Italian mother who killed the man who was trying to rape her, Grace became known as the people's friend and was soon one of the busiest lawyers in the city. She then noticed the disturbing pattern of young men going missing and followed the clues all the way to Florida, where she uncovered a system of forced slavery through debt 40 years after the close of the Civil War. She reported, and this was a plantation she found in Arkansas. It was an island, and it was called Sunnyside. And it was effectively a slave plantation 40 years after the Civil War had ended, using Italian immigrants. And the cotton company would lure these people from Italy, saying, come to America, we'll give you a job. And they had them sign all the paperwork, and they, of course, couldn't speak English. And they were really signing their lives away because it was a system of debt that they could not get out of, that they literally had to work until they died and were buried on the plantation. So it was a loophole for these very unscrupulous and evil cotton plantation owners to get cheap labor after the Civil War. And she uncovered this. She infiltrated the camp in disguise, selling scissors, and it was a big case for her. After testifying before Congress and making front-page news with the Sunnyside case, Grace returned to New York and once again threw herself into the strange and unusual cases that somehow always found their way to her desk. She fought against the same doctor who tormented the famous reporter Nellie Bly when she went undercover at an insane asylum and was marked for death by the Sinister Black Hand, the Italian crime organization that used secret codes and mystical rituals. Eventually, one of Grace's rich society friends, Mrs. Felix Adler, called to tell her that a girl had gone missing in New York and begged her to meet with the father of the girl, one Mr. Henry Krueger. By the time Grace agreed to take the case, Ruth Krueger's photo had appeared in newspapers all over the country. Her image even flickered in front of movie theater audiences. The press, drawn to the story of a pretty Sunday school teacher who had vanished, openly suspected white slavery, foul play, and romantic entanglement, sometimes all in the same story. Clues were flooding the detective precincts, but none of them panned out. But Grace took a different approach to the case. She locked herself in her office for a week to study every scrap of paper related to it. Grace had been trained as a lawyer, but her inability to trust the police, or even the law itself, had, over the last few years, turned her into more of a detective. Now, at age 48, her formula was to search for clues herself, verify them, and use them in the courtroom to make her arguments. She didn't trust the police, so she effectively just found her own evidence. In this case, Grace kept coming back to Alfredo Cocchi, the man who had sharpened Ruth's skates. Since being questioned by detectives, Cocchi had also disappeared. Though most of his neighbors speculated, he simply feared being made a scapegoat for the crime, especially because he was Italian. The police, it seemed, could blame his people for anything in those days. And it's true at this time, everyone blamed the Italians. If anything was criminally related, they would just blame the Italians. But though Cocchi's place had already been searched, his motorcycle shop was the last place Ruth had been seen. Grace wanted to see it herself. This is how Grace ended up standing in the middle of Manhattan Avenue in Harlem and staring up at the Metropolitan Motorcycle Shop in June of 1917. Grace craned her neck and took in the tall glass windows that ran almost 10 feet high across the front of the store. The white lettering across the glass read, "Motorcycle Storing" on the left and "Auto Supplies" on the right. She saw tin signs for Mobil Oil that hung still in the air. A single globe lamp hung off a pole in front of the entrance, and a huge billboard for graham crackers, as big as long as the shop itself, rose off the roof and into the blue sky. The inside of Cocchi's shop was dim behind the smoked glass. Maria Cocchi, Alfredo's wife, had been left behind and was now, when her husband disappeared, and was now desperately trying to keep the store afloat. She had two small children. Maria, who claimed to have no knowledge of where her husband was, had refused any further searching of the premises. The police were no help either. As Grace moved from desk to desk in city buildings, trying to gain entrance to the store, police officials smiled and said their hands were tied. Grace was limited to what she could see from the outside. There were two signs in the window that read, "Mechanics Help Wanted" and "Selling Out." On the outside, to the left of the front door, was a narrow stairwell that sank into the ground and served as a separate entrance to the basement. Grace walked near these stairs as unobtrusively as possible. Grace knew, like it or not, that all of her misgivings about Cocchi and his store were all circumstantial. The police had searched the cellar twice and found nothing but absence. The rest was gossip and headlines. Why was Cocchi missing? Because he had taken the girl? Because he had been spirited away by the same fiends who had taken poor Ruth? Or was he just terrified of being blamed by proximity? Perhaps there were more sinister forces at work, such as the rumored white slavery ring that stretched all the way down to Brazil. Or was this the work of the Black Hand? There were even rumors that Cocchi had been very friendly with the motorcycle cops in his neighborhood. Grace knew that those questions might be the most dangerous ones, but they still had to be asked. Pause. Considering the options at play in her mind, intersecting like the city itself, still struggling to connect its new boroughs into one unified whole. Perhaps Ruth and Kochi were the happy couple in this after all. That version of the truth seemed remote. But still, Grace went back to her office, thinking through the heat, trying to come up with a plan. When she got to her office, she called her good friend, the private detective named Julius J. Crone. Crone was a federal agent when he was first assigned to Grace during her U.S. District Attorney days. And Grace, one of the things I found out, she was the first female U.S. District Attorney. This is, I think, a major historical point, and you have to look really, 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 really hard to find it anywhere. It's a major accomplishment. A proud son of Hungary, with dark features and a scar under his left eye, Crone had a keen mind and chomped on cigars. When he was first hired, representatives of a southern plantation offered him a substantial amount of money for a jury list on a peonage case. Crone smiled and agreed, but not before setting up a sting in an Italian restaurant with the help of the Secret Service. After that, he was known as the man who could not be bribed. He and Grace had been partners when needed ever since. He's kind of like her Watson, except he's really prone to punching people in the face. You really, these characters are not, and, you know, again, I hate true crime, but you can't make this up. And that's what makes it so good. He has a scar and an accent, and he punches people in the face. At the Hotel Manhattan on Madison and 42nd, Grace still Crone in on the particulars of Ruth Krueger's disappearance over oysters. Crone knew about the case from the newspapers. I want you to meet Mr. Krueger, the girl's father, Grace told her grim friend between sips of tea. He is a mental and physical wreck. If this isn't solved soon, he'll be in a sanitarium. When they left the hotel at 8, Grace gave Crone the bulk of the files she had on the case, hundreds of typewritten pages. Crone took the pages home and studied them all night long, making big blue pencil marks over the most promising leads. In the morning, he blinked his eyes, took an icy shower, and ate breakfast. Before leaving, Crone kissed his wife, Estelle, and his three young daughters goodbye. After what he had just read, he tarried over them a moment more. When Crone arrived at Grace's office, he found her already talking to Henry Krueger, who looked completely washed of color and form. When Grace introduced Crone, Krueger's eyes pleaded at him from under his bushy eyebrows and bald head. "Mr. Crone," he said, "won't you find my little daughter? Someone is keeping her. She would never stay away. She would never have gone away." "We hope to, Mr. Krueger," Crone replied with his sliding accent. He added, "Just remember that all of the thousands of girls who disappear every year, over 98% are located." Crone managed a persuasive smile through the lie. "Yes," Henry cried, "but where?" Crone had no immediate answer. Both Grace and Crone knew that in the past year, 828 people had gone missing from the city of New York. 244 people had been murdered. "Either New York is the most criminal city in the world," Grace would say, "or the police force is inefficient." After Krueger left, Grace looked at her right-hand man. "Crony," she said, "you are the only man I can trust to dig up the real facts. There is something crooked behind this whole thing." For the next week, Grace split her time between the office and searching cellars, vacant lots, and asking questions around the tenement. The police made fun of her. But Grace was adamant that Ruth was not a wayward girl who had eloped as a result of a senseless head. Every interview she had with Ruth's friends and acquaintances had suggested otherwise. And this is, I think, one of her great legacies, that in the past, when a girl would go missing, it was always her fault. And, you know, to some extent, this still happens. But Grace was adamant that it wasn't her fault, that she knew that someone had done this to her, and it changed the whole investigation. Crone had disappeared as well, as Grace knew he would, going deep into the case. When he finally called, Grace had started to set her own larger plan into motion. "Mrs. Humiston," Crone said, "I've got something on Cochi." An hour later, Crone sat across from Grace at the hotel again. He looked over his shoulder and dropped his voice. Crone told Grace about someone he had talked to who used to live on Cochi Street. Her name was Madame Murillo, and she was a French actress who lived with her 16-year-old daughter, Philippa. Their house was across the street from the motorcycle shop. When Philippa's bicycle broke one summer, her mother sent her to get it fixed by Cochi. When Philippa came back, her bike was not only fixed, but it was white. The girl opened her hand and showed her mother a rose that Cochi had given her. Another day, Philippa went over to the motorcycle store to see if Cochi could attach a small motor to her bicycle. Cochi wiped his hands on his rag, looked at her bike, and said he'd do it for her cheap, just for her. "Oh, really?" said her mother when her daughter told her. "Yes," said Philippa, "because he told me he likes me." As her mother watched from the window, she saw Cochi and her daughter Philippa go into the store. Suddenly, she had a sense of unease and ran down to the street. When she reached the head of the basement steps, she heard her daughter screaming, "Mother, mother!" Her mother screamed her daughter's name, and she came flying out, sobbing and shaking with terror. The sleeve of her dress had been ripped loose. "I could see the spots already turning blue," her mother said, "from the grip of the man's fingers." "I want all mothers to know," she said, "how easily these things can happen. There was that man right across the street from us, and yet he dared to commit this deed in broad daylight within a few yards of our home. I wanted to go at once to the police, and I'm sorry now that I didn't. I had forgotten the name of the motorcycle man on Manhattan Street until his face stared at me from the paper." Finishing her tea, Grace was seeing someone new appear in her mind, something worse, and he had been under their faces the whole time. She had a new fact she was now absolutely sure of. "This man," Grace said, "should have been behind bars years ago." "We'll make up for that," said Crone. But they needed evidence to catch the monster and to hopefully find Ruth alive. They needed to get into that store and the mysterious cellar beneath it. Grace had been thinking about this problem almost constantly. She saw an opening that wouldn't make them reliant on the unhelpful police. In fact, it would probably be best if they didn't even know about it. She then asked Crone a very strange, pointed question. She asked him if he knew how to fix a motorcycle. That night, Crone took out some ragged clothes and puzzled over a borrowed motorcycle repair manual. He stayed up late, with the aid of coffee and light, trying to figure out how to fix an all-chain drive. The next morning, Crone knocked on the door at Cochi's store. When Maria Cochi answered, Crone told her he was here for the job. She looked him over, then asked what experience he had. "Several years," replied Crone quickly, looking her directly in the eyes. "Then get to work," Mrs. Cochi said. "Clean out that clogged gasoline on the red one first." Crone paused. He had never monkeyed with a motorcycle before. He had a car of his own and could tinker it up all right, but he'd have to experiment with the cycle. And he hated these clothes. He was a notorious dresser. He always would always wear these tweed jackets, even in the summer. So in having to dress down for this job, he didn't like it. But she was standing right there, watching him. "What are you standing there?" she said. Crone heard her emphasis on there and looked down at his feet. He was standing on an iron grating that had hot air blowing up from the basement. It was late spring, so there should be no need for heat, Crone thought. He wondered if there was equipment down there. Why, I'm looking for a place to hitch my coat, said Crone, stalling. Mrs. Cochi pointed with her thumb to a nail on the wall. As he hung up his coat, Crone asked, is there any other helper here, ma'am? If you don't mind my asking. Do mind you asking, Maria answered, mimicking him. Don't ask so many damn questions. And this is actual, I'm not making this, all the dialogue in here, none of it's made up. It's either from court documents or there's some other stories on it. For a week, Julius J. Crone, the Hungarian detective who could not be bribed, fumbled and bluffed his way through motorcycle repairs as Maria Cochi watched over him like a hawk. Crone would commit the bike's maladies to heart, learn how to fix them at night by reading the manuals, and try to put this knowledge into effect the next day. He had more than surprising success. The more daunting exercise was dealing with Mrs. Cochi. All the while, Crone reported back to Grace everything he was learning about the shop. They would meet at her office or in hotels and would pass on the information. The one-story building was largely taken over by motorcycles, most of their repairs long overdue. There was a workshop in the cellar, but it was only accessible through the outside stairs in the front. Mrs. Cochi never let him go down there. Whenever he needed tools, she would go down and bring them up herself. Crone didn't think she trusted him, or anyone for that matter. On the fifth day of Crone's new job as a mechanic, the customer brought in a motorcycle that needed three of the front wheel spokes replaced. All Crone needed to do was solder it, but the equipment was in the basement. Without pause, Crone began to put on his hat and coat. Mrs. Cochi stopped him. Where are you going now? She asked. The smithy, to get these spokes soldered. You don't need to go to no smithy, Mrs. Cochi said. I'll take you downstairs and you can use the heater there. Crone put his hat and coat back on the tack. He made sure to control his breathing and to conceal his eyes. Mrs. Cochi wiped her hands, and he followed her outside the shop. At the front sidewalk, there were four steps that led down to the cellar. As Mrs. Cochi remained standing on top to watch the store, Crone jumped down. Mrs. Cochi kept an eye on him as he went inside. When Crone entered the basement, he tried to take it all in as quickly as possible. There was no lavish furnished space, or medieval dungeon. There was only a workbench, a massive tool chest, some rags in a corner, and the slick smell of motor oil. There were two windows facing the front small alley. Crone scanned the wooden boards on the floor for new damage or shiny bright nails, but even the dust was uniform. Crone knew that the police had already searched this room twice. Don't you see the heater there in front of you? Mrs. Cochi shouted from the stairs. There was a pause. Crone looked around again for a footprint or a scuff. Anything out of the ordinary. He started searching the back wall when he suddenly realized he had taken too long. Never mind, come on up, Mrs. Cochi said quickly. Take the spokes to the smithy. At that moment, Crone was convinced of two things by Mrs. Cochi's high-pitched voice. One, that there must be some kind of tiny clue in that basement. And two, that the jig was up. Crone grabbed the spokes and scrambled up the stairs. He could hear a customer in the shop. Maybe Mrs. Cochi just wanted him out of the cellar rather than leave him unattended. Maybe there was nothing down there after all. The tools were valuable, but not as valuable as what he was looking for. There was no secret cell or hidden door, or at least he had not seen one. It was just an ordinary New York cellar. Maybe Mrs. Cochi hadn't noticed his absence at all. But when he came up the stairs, her eyes were locked on him. I know you now, she said. You're another of those detectives that chased poor Al away. You're no mechanic. You're a hound. She broke down crying, get out, get out, get out. As Crone was pushed out into the snow, he had failed Grace. Her plan had worked beautifully until he got in that basement and had blown his cover. Crone slouched inside and walked away from the store alongside the black cars. He was convinced completely that he had missed something in that underground room. He understood now. He would stop at nothing, to get back to that still space to find out what really happened to Ruth Krueger. Thank you. So I think we're going to do some questions, if anyone has any. Polly's walking around with a microphone. If anyone has any questions or comments? Or...
Hi there. You mentioned that she disappeared. And any information at all about where she ended up and what happened?
So this is a new book for me. I mean, it just came out 2 weeks ago. And I'm kind of, in starting to do these readings and such, I'm trying to answer questions, but at the same time, not giving out spoilers. Because I know I don't like it, you know, and it's so hard nowadays, you know, because everybody, you know, but I can't answer your question. There's very little information we have about why she disappears. And I have a theory in the book as to why she disappears. But I can, you know, say a few things. So she takes on final case. You know, Sherlock Holmes has this great final case. Her final case involves she takes on the U.S. Army, which is not a small enemy. And what happens is people involved in this case stretch back to her earliest, some of her earliest cases. I think the short way of saying it is when you're someone like her who gets a lot done and who is a woman, she made many enemies. And I think at the end of her career, the enemies finally come out, and they make decisions that get rid of her. And I don't mean to say get rid of her like, you know, mafioso get rid of her, but there's an assassination attempt on her, maybe two. I think it's two. But I think her end is, in some ways, it doesn't matter. You know, because she would say it was the fight that mattered. But the end of her life is, I think, fascinating. And I think there's a couple cases she does at the end that, you know, again, you can't make this stuff up. But it's not a fictional character. And, you know, I joke around and I hate true crime. But it's, I really don't, because it's real. You know, I mean, I wish it wasn't real, but it is real. So she's not like Sherlock Holmes, who kind of gets through everything and everything's happy, you know, except for the morphine use. But she's a human being, and she has a pretty dramatic fall at the end of this book. Very dramatic.
Hey, I have a question about the tone and the language that you chose to use for this piece, for this book. Like as you say, it is a mystery in many ways, but you also did so much research from the papers and all. How did you decide about the voice, or did it find you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think it's I like putting the reader there because I know I like that as a reader. So. I try to, when I do description, I look at a lot of old photographs. So I was lucky I got two photographs of the store. And I promise you every detail in those photographs found its way to this book, but, you know, the graham cracker sign. And so I don't make stuff up. It's all there. But I think that it rings true. As far as the language, I really wanted it to have some of that, you know, early, you read these papers long enough and it just starts to leave its mark. You know, the language back then is very fast. And there's all these great slang words. So I just kind of used them as is. And I think, you know, there's nothing you have to, like, look up, you know, it's all, but they have a lot of different terms and strange terms. But I wanted it to have, because part of what I want to investigate is the role of mass media in this. And, you know, mass media just takes this story and explodes it. And so I'm interested in, does that help Ruth Krueger or does that hurt Ruth Krueger? And the mass media, the newspapers at this time, everything's just this huge, big thing. So there's a lot of hyperbole. There's a lot of big talk. But so that's part of it, too. I wanted it to have that kind of noir feeling to it, too, because it's a mystery, you know?
I think we're going to cut it off there, and you can go. It's the video is actually only about half done, so you can go there and listen to Brad Ricker talk more about this book, but he delves more into the history of this, I think, as the video goes on. But anyway, kind of interesting, isn't it? A woman detective, famous, and gone after and sought after by other people who saw her as serious competition and the criminals as enemies, on and on and on. So very interesting thing. On the book talk tonight, I want to mention one thing, a book that you might want to take a look at that I just downloaded on my Kindle Paperwhite. And the book is called Turo, T-U-R-O-W. The book is called The Isles Have Eyes. And ladies and gentlemen, this book is fantastic. It is an in-depth discussion of what's going on surveillance in our society within the consumer product market in your stores and all over the place. You know, you walk into stores, you say, oh, okay, there's a big surveillance camera up there. These little beacons are in the aisles around products and all kinds of things. If you got your cell phone on, they've recorded that. They record how long now you stay around a particular project. They look at that and they decide, okay, if he really liked that project, if we can bring him back to the store, what we'll do is we'll give them a discount when they check out and go through the checkout line on that product, and they'll hand you a coupon for something else. But guess what else they're doing? They're selling all that data to somebody else, and it's all connected with this. It's the algorithm world. All this is connected to, you know, audio listening at home on products, and they sell it to these companies, and they analyze it and package it in certain ways and sell it to other people. And all this, at least in the product market, is to keep you in business as opposed to just buying things online. But it's a very interesting book, and nobody has done detail on this like he has on this particular point, at this particular point in society. So take a look at that book, The Isles Have Eyes. And if that happens to be on Book TV, it wasn't a week or so ago, we're going to bring him on and let him talk about that particular book. Okay, that's it for tonight. And we're going to ask Marilyn to sign us off, as she usually does, singing We'll Meet Again.
Sunny day.